Welcome to Connect the Dots, a podcast that explores today's most pressing issues and what that means for you, your family, and community. This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Progressive Reform. It is supported in part by the Arlie Shart Fund for Climate Justice and the Center on Environment, Land, and Law at Loyola University, New Orleans.
Hey there, I'm Rob Virchik, and this is Connect the Dots. This season, we're exploring environmental and climate justice wins across the country. How have individuals, communities, and states had an impact, and how can we replicate their achievements elsewhere? For this episode of Rants and Raves, I went exploring outside again. So you might hear a little bit of a breeze, a few birds, it's all good. Here it is. All right, it is time for a rave. If you listen carefully, you might hear some sparrows in the background. There's a little breeze that you might hear. That's because I'm in Clinton, Washington, a rural area in the western part of the state that actually is very significant to many indigenous peoples that can trace their lineage all the way back to the Coast Salish people who were here over 1,000 years ago. This is a good spot to be in for my rave, which is to make a shout out to another important rural landscape in the American West. This one involves Chaco Canyon, which is near the Four Corners area of New Mexico. Just recently, in this month of June, Secretary of Interior Deb Haaland made an announcement granting greater protections to Chaco Canyon. Well, I'm going to tell you about that in just a second. But the first thing, though, I want to tell you is a little bit about Chaco Canyon and why it's so important. So Chaco Canyon, it is a staggeringly beautiful place in the high desert in New Mexico. The other thing, though, that's really important about it, it is one of the most culturally significant landscapes for Native American culture in all of North America. The Chacoan civilization was based around Chaco Canyon. And today there are remains of villages, village plazas, great houses that are over 1,000 years old. There are literally hundreds of archaeological sites that you can visit, that you can hike through, that all of us can learn from. This is in fact an area that's not only part of a national park, but is also a UNESCO World Heritage Site. There's one other thing I haven't told you about Chaco Canyon, and that is that right below the surface is an amazing network of pockets of oil and gas, and that for generations, this area has been developed for oil and gas. And you might know that in New Mexico, that's a really important thing. A lot of revenue to the state comes from the development of oil and gas. And that's not a good environmental story, of course, because one of the things that happens with that development is it disrupts a lot of the habitat in this landscape. And it also creates a lot of pollution, including, you know, these big methane plumes, for instance, and other kinds of air pollution that threaten the health of many indigenous communities in the area. And so what Secretary Haaland did recently was make an announcement that the Bureau of Land Management was now going to block any further leasing on federal land of properties for the use of oil and gas development. No more oil and gas development on federal land, at least through new leases of federal land. And that was going to be in effect within a 10-mile radius of all of Chaco Canyon. Folks, that is a tremendous win for this area and for many of the people who live here. Now, you might want to ask, well, how does something like that happen? I mean, is it that just one day somebody in the Bureau of Land Management wakes up and says, my God, I want to cheese off the oil and gas industry by protecting this canyon in New Mexico that most Americans have never seen and probably never even heard of? All right. So I've worked in government, and I'll tell you, folks, that is not how it happens. The way it happens, and the way it happened in this situation, is that for decades, many local groups who cared about this area organized and educated people about it. Small organizations to begin with that grew larger. Organizations like the Pueblo Action Alliance or the Native Organizers Alliance. Groups like this would team up in larger coalitions. They'd join together with larger organizations like the Center for Biodiversity, for instance. And over years and years, they'd work at the local, the state, and the federal level in Washington, D.C. to get their point across and to lobby for stronger and stronger protection. This is what my mother-in-law might say is the kind of success that arises when preparation and opportunity meet. So that preparation, decades of work at the grassroots and local level. The opportunity, the Biden administration and Secretary Holland coming together and saying, you know what, we are going to dedicate ourselves to working harder for Native American interests in the United States. And so there you go. Lots of preparation on the part of many small groups joining together, and then an opportunity that arises. That's how change happens. And so a big shout out to Chaco Canyon and all of the community who belong to that area and are now celebrating some environmental protection in this area. And the rest of us, we should rave about this too. Tell other people about it and look for opportunities that are similar, because there might be something in your community, in your state, that you care an awful lot about, and you can join together with people already doing hard work in that area, and you will be prepared when opportunity knocks. In this episode, I had the privilege of speaking with Brett Isaac. He's the co-founder of Navajo Power, a public benefit corporation that develops clean energy projects on tribal lands and maximizes the economic benefits of those communities. Navajo Power now has projects under development with tribal partners in New Mexico, Arizona, California, and Oregon. This company is really something because even after solar installation, Navajo Power continues to support households with maintenance and troubleshooting, which a lot of solar companies don't do. Back in February 2023, Brett was appointed to President Biden's Export Council. That serves as the principal national advisory committee on international trade. The council advises the president of government policies and programs that impact U.S. trade. The council works to promote export expansion, and it advises on a number of decisions related to business, industry, agriculture, and labor. One note about the audio in this episode. You might hear a little bit of static on Brett's end of the conversation. We want to apologize for that, particularly to any listeners who are hard of hearing. But this is a great conversation, and I learned a lot, so I hope that you enjoy it. Brett Isaac, thanks so much for joining us on Connect the Dots. I have a question really about Navajo Power and how it got started. But before I ask that, I'm interested in knowing about your life growing up in Kienta near a coal mine. And for those who don't know this area, this is on the Navajo Nation, and I think it's just south of Monument Valley. It's beautiful country in certain areas, but you grew up near a coal mine that had a lot of challenges with pollution and contamination. And I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about your experience growing up.
That's really what starts everything for me was the the proximity, the impact. In the 90s, I'm going to date myself with this, but in the 90s, the company would issue like company vehicles, and they were these bright yellow trucks, and you'd see them all over town. And like, that's how you knew who the company men were, was they'd be driving these bright yellow coal mining trucks through town wearing safety vests. And a lot of my family, you know, my uncle, both my grandfathers, they all worked in the mine. You know, most of them just finished high school and then basically went to the coal mine and started working there. My grandfather was Hopi, and he had worked at the mine, you know, from the very beginning. But it was interesting, is like he didn't know how to use a computer or even a calculator, but but he was an electrician. Just growing up in my head, I always think about how there was status there. When I got older, the one thing I started to notice, though, was these men and women worked relentlessly. Like, they worked 7-hour shifts, they worked double shifts, they worked weekends. And the kids that I grew up with, you know, their versions of their parents were when they came home, you know, between a shift and basically slept, ate, got ready, and then went right back to work. So the thing I did start to notice is, although there was economic gains from it, there was also this sense of like a type of worker that the Navajo people were, and also a type of like lifestyle. And I kind of learned how that was impactful later on when they started like this slow decommissioning process and laying off workers. It wasn't creating the generational wealth working in that mine. In fact, you know, a lot of those people, although it was a really good paying job, were still stuck in that cycle of paycheck to paycheck and, you know, still limited in the opportunities that came from it.
Now, you had a power station in the Navajo Nation, too, generating electricity from this coal. Did your community use the electricity?
So, no. The Navajo Generating Station was a 2.2 gigawatt coal-fired power plant. You know, so right on the edge of the Navajo Nation, and you could see those stacks for miles. There was a couple uses. So the state of California, Nevada Energy, Salt River Project, Arizona Public Service, Tucson Electric Power were the major corporate owners. And then the Bureau of Reclamation took a portion of that power, and I believe it was like 23%, and they used it to power the canal systems that would move water from the Colorado River down to Phoenix and Tucson. But none of it, you know, was tapped back into the community. So for years, we had these huge transmission lines running over houses that didn't have electricity.
Wow. So were you powered by generators?
We were served by WAPA. So the Navajo Nation has a small utility. They did have one substation in Kayenta, but they procured power on the market. And as a Western Area Power Authority customer, essentially they were serviced by that entity. There's like 15,000 homes on the Navajo Nation that don't have access to energy because that distribution system was concentrated in like just the most dense populated areas. But when you have like 26,000 square miles of terrain to cover, it gets rather expensive, especially because we're not densely populated. So a large amount of the population runs off of generators. Prior to forming Navajo Power, I had worked in off-grid. I started a local company called Shanto Energy and then had done some off-grid development work myself. Eventually, you know, getting a few hundred homes powered. But it was very hard, expensive, and there was a lot of barriers to it. One particular one that really pops up is just access to, you know, financial instruments is very limited for Navajo households. So we don't have commercial banking or retail that supports that. And, you know, the cost of energizing a home through the traditional grid system is upwards of $100,000 per house just in the cost of the infrastructure extending out. So solar became an option. But the technology 10 years ago was still kind of limited, you know, in terms of the cost of it and the availability. Navajo Power just launched a solar as a service company called Navajo Power Home, and it provides a more affordable solution that is basically a little solar system done at each individual residence. So there's solar plus batteries. So it provides 24-hour power to these homes that were running off of generators. We did an economic study and saw that people were spending $150 to $300 a month just on the fuel.
One thing I just want to point out, I think, for our listeners is that there are significant areas in the United States, communities, many of them native communities, that don't have the kind of access to electricity that other Americans enjoy. During the 1930s, we know that there was this great movement to bring electricity to far-flung areas or sparsely populated areas in the United States. And that basically passed by native communities. And so even today, we're talking about trying to electrify sparsely populated areas. Can you tell me a little bit about Navajo Power?
We're a development company focusing on developing large-scale projects in tribal lands. And we currently have a pipeline of 3 gigawatts under development on the Navajo Nation and other tribal lands across the West. Tribal lands can be a very opportunistic place to site these projects. One, because the availability of land, but also the abandonment of infrastructure, coal plants retiring, natural gas facilities, you know, kind of going offline, there leaves like a bit of a, you know, an area where tribally sited projects could be competitive. The other thing is being regenerative to the economies. Our predominant technology we focus on now is solar and storage. But we're dealing with a lot of the same issues that they have nationally with the grid, you know, because we are selling to a regional market. And so that amount of power, you know, in our philosophy would be exported out to a large energy user, usually utilities that already have existing transmission rights in the region. And then we bring the revenues back to the communities and to the tribal nation and figure out how to use those, you know, in an effective way so that it doesn't continue to replicate, you know, the extractive systems that industries used to have.
Are you able to get electricity to households on your tribal lands that did not previously have access?
And that's the purpose of Navajo Power Home. So we created that organization essentially to do that. You know, so since August, they've powered about 100 homes. We started it essentially to bring an option, but also create jobs. Residential solar is one of the more sustainable job creators because it requires consistent maintenance.
And you are a public benefit corporation. And so I think that a majority of your profits, they go into the community.
We invest back into future projects, you know, so as a investment strategy, once we generate revenue, 80% of it gets recycled back into developing more projects. We've kind of challenged our investors to use that action to create what we call a Mission Delta Fund. So when we're successful and we repay back our credit facilities, a portion of the interest that the investors agreed upon goes into a community development fund, and even challenges like energy and water access.
And that's another issue, because access to running water is an issue on tribal lands in the Southwest too, with people actually trucking in tanks of water, right?
So I grew up like that. We had to haul our water to, you know, for our home and for, we're ranchers, so we have livestock. It was probably about 2016 that my family's ranch finally got running water in the Navajo Nations.
You're working on projects that can be replicated in other areas on tribal lands. Are those in other places?
And we're talking other states. So we currently have some other projects. I can't tell you exactly where they are, but I can give you generalizations, like up in Oregon, down in Southern California, and in other parts of Arizona. Once people found out about our philosophy and what we're doing, we definitely had a lot of interest, and we do proactively look to develop more projects. A great example of one reason we're doing this work is, you know, with the passing of the Inflation Reduction Act, it created a provision that really highlighted tribal access to capital by offering investment tax credits through direct pay to tribal, you know, entities. Prior to us doing the work that we're doing, tribes had a very limited role they could play in the development space. But with that, it's created an opportunity. Now, we feel our work's now more important because to get projects ready to be in a stage that is competitive, as well as, you know, the opportunities coming, we got to do this work over and over and over again in different communities. Building a project like this involves like land acquisition and debt structuring. It's all things they need to learn in order for them to become proficient at developing any other thing they want to develop for their community.
How did you develop your own expertise?
One of the great things about the solar industry and clean energy in general is there's a low threshold to entry. You know, if I want to get into nuclear, I got to start in some huge plant with billions of dollars behind me. But in solar, I can start with one house, one panel, one battery, and essentially scale that every single time going up. These communities have an issue with trust. Industries have come in and have had negative effects on them in the past. And so what my expertise really started from was being that interpreter between the community and the industry, learning a lot more about the development landscape as it pertains to tribal code, tribal laws, and the nexus between the investment world and what an actual project can do. And through years of just kind of watching a lot of developers strike out, I started to see what it was they were missing. What we wanted to do is add patience and add a bit of empathy into the process. So becoming a bit more understanding of the circumstance, understanding the relationship to land, being culturally attuned.
Now, do you ever get pushback in the tribal communities?
Oh yeah. Again, there's a lot of traumatic instances where nuclear or coal or natural gas came through, made a lot of promises and didn't fulfill them. The same people that did the development work of those other facilities are the same people that are, you know, taking off their Exxon logo and putting on a solar panel and saying, hey, I'm back, you know, but I got this new thing. The communities themselves that are kind of setting this standard, at least for us, on what they want to see in terms of the level of, you know, capability you have to have and also the level of attention to detail. You got to remember, we're in former coal communities and we're in oil and gas communities. So you got like company men too that are coming in saying solar is the worst thing in the world. It's going to take our jobs. It's robbing our income. And we just have to go back to like, this is an alternative opportunity.
You know, as you tell me this, I think of where I'm living now. I live in New Orleans, and in southern Louisiana, there is an attempt to expand more solar farms too, and often on agricultural land. And in the southern Louisiana area, there are a lot of African-American communities. There are tribal communities too, and they're generally distrustful of any industry coming in and saying, let me give you a new offer. And it hasn't gone so well in the past.
Tribal lands have been, they have like certain connotations about them. One, you know, we were put onto reservations, you know, centuries ago. There's a historical and an ancestral tie to this land because it's diminished, you know, over the years. And a lot of these communities definitely feel that pressure of opportunity slipping, but also it's land that's affected in all kinds of different ways. We got climate change essentially affecting the quality of grazing. We got droughts, you know, we got natural disasters. We got all these things that are really kind of we're staring at and trying to figure out how do we contribute to a solution. You know, there isn't a dollar per acre figure that would ever be fair, but there's one we got to get them comfortable with, you know.
I know that you were recently named to President Biden's Export Council. And I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about what the Export Council does and what your role on that council will be.
The Biden administration has very specific, you know, policies it wants to, you know, focus on in terms of its international trade relations. We used to produce a lot more things locally, you know, and in order to do so, we need to develop local infrastructure. We got to have that kind of conversation. The other is the indigenous lens. Typically, you know, in almost every development conversation and every energy conversation in the country, in North America particularly, there's always an indigenous element to it. But part of previous administration's failures are listening to indigenous voices and including indigenous voices onto their advisement. This is one of the first administrations that has proactively gone out and included indigenous voices and experts into rooms that we weren't privy to before. And so by the time that we were aware of some of these developments, you know, there had been a mob forming at the gate basically saying, why are we doing this?
I think that's a really good point, right? Because, and we see that in communities of all kinds where, you know, it's reactive when people just learn that something is about to be built in, you know, in their backyard and they had no notice about it or any kind of planning. I kind of think of Biden's work in developing the national monuments, the expansion of Bears Ears, and now the announcement of the area in Spirit Mountain down where I grew up in southern Nevada. My sense is there's a lot more control, a lot more consultation among the tribal communities in those endeavors too.
A lot of the native communities have been skeptical of our governmental system. And it's only recently become kind of a national thing that people are skeptical of their government. You know, there used to be a lot of just like go along with it and this is good for the country. I think being critical, one, is it's good, you know, because it does bring out the conversations that need to be had. And at one point that was just flat out ignored. Just because something is led by Indigenous people doesn't differentiate that it isn't still Americans leading American values and American things.
Are you hopeful about your developments, the solar developments, and about the development of your communities in general?
No matter who I talk to, you know, the things that I say about our approach, they're universally like applauded because they're the right thing. We're just, again, adding patience into a process that needed it. We're slowing some things down that were getting a little bit hard for people to hold on to and grasp. And we're giving that space for people to get comfortable with the transition conversation.
Brett Isaac, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast by the Center for Progressive Reform. For more information, visit us at progressivereform.org or follow us on Instagram at Progressive Reform, all one word, or catch up with us on Twitter at CPR Blog, all one word. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and don't forget to leave us a review. It helps us to reach more listeners like you who want to connect the dots on today's most pressing issues. I'd like to thank our guest today, Brett Isaac, as well as our producer, Maggie DeWayne, and our editor, Courtney Garcia. Our theme music is by Lobo Loco and Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Rob Virchik. Until next time, be safe and take care of one another.